All right, I am thrilled to be reading back at Hemingway's, where I haven't read in 20 years. The first place I read in Pittsburgh, when I was just a wee lad, they really took a chance on me. And I'm also thrilled to be reading with the person who made me what I am today, whatever that may be, Jim Daniels. He chose this book out of a pile of thousands as the winner of a contest, and it was my first book. So, Jim, that was very prescient, and I've been thanking you ever since then. And do I have to... My final thank you is going to be a tribute by reading a poem from that book. All right, just to prove that you were so right in choosing this book. I lived in New York for a summer. That's the great thing about being a teacher, and back when it was affordable. And since I felt so guilty about hanging out in Manhattan and not doing anything, I volunteered at a soup kitchen. And it was one of the biggest soup kitchen, largest soup kitchen in the country, maybe even the Western Hemisphere or something. And it was kind of like an assembly line. And the guy standing next to me looked very familiar. I finally figured it out. This is called Albert Einstein at the Soup Kitchen. "Do I look like anyone?" he asks, as he swoops the long spoon into the peas, lifts it a few inches and holds it steady to pour onto the tray of the next famished mouth, shouts to George for more as his supply empties down. I'm the bread and donut man in this assembly line of volunteers who gather for our 3 hours of weekly service and socialism. There's Jose, the finger-pointing Filipino, who pours the punch and repeats, "The wages of sin is death," and only reads Paradise from the Divine Comedy. For his description of heaven, he tells me, and of light. And then there's Jake the Buddhist, who scrapes the dishes as they are returned, saves whatever appears untouched for someone else's insatiable hunger. And then there's Sal, who tells me he was on the other side of the line, meaning he was one of the thousand who form every morning single file around the church around this Church of the Apostles, up 9th Avenue and around 28th Street. "Like the snake," he chants, looking out the window beyond Crack Park, "cursed above the beasts of the city to eat dust all the days of its life." And their eyes are filled with dust, drugged and sleepy, bodies stiff from sidewalk cardboard sofas. The pea man, it turns out, looks like Albert Einstein. The shaggy white hair and the white mustache, the pronounced nose and the dark, sad eyes. "I'm an actor," he explains. "They pay me to look like the genius." He shows me his card, E equals MC squared. Equity equals many characters. And I'm honored to be near even the resemblance of the man, not because I understand relativity and the contradicting theories of light, but because of how steady he is with a spoon, filling each helping to the brim, as if each portion should be equal and abundant. So, thank you, Jim Daniels. And it's just wonderful to read with both of you. And thanks so much, Joan, for setting this all up. And Hemingway's is still exactly the same, as I remember. Since we're in a restaurant bar, I thought I'd read a restaurant bar poem. There's some work poems in the first part. And I worked at a restaurant called the Lobster Pot. Figure that one out. I was 15, and so I couldn't drive. So... this is the story about my experience there. It's called Lobsters. Mickey got me high for the first time in the woods behind the parking lot of the Lobster Pot, where we worked our shifts. When customers thinned out and the manager smoked and drank at the bar with the waitresses, we'd reach our hands into the cold water of the tank, grab the back of a hard shell, wooden pegs clamping their claws, and place them on the carpet, their alien bodies squirming and sliding, off course, aimless in this strange element. Not like when our huge black cook in the boiling kitchen would drop them straight into the bubbling water. "Hotter than hell in here," she'd shout, chugging a dripping bottle of Stroh's, as I lined dirty dish after dirty dish onto the rack to be conveyed into the machine under age and over time, paid off the clock. Way past when I was to call home for a ride, Mickey, pockmarked, thick black hair greased back, led me into the after-hour dark, through the few parked cars and into the darker woods. I thought, toking in this new freedom, of my parents waiting by the phone, until we saw the police car's headlights slicing the night like swords, and Mickey blending in with the blur, and I knew a hand was lifting me above this impossible to imagine next moment. So that was my time with Mickey. He might be doing time now, as far as I know. When I was about 20, whenever he graduated from college, I went to New York, the big city, and I was going to go to school there, and I got a place, and I was, you know, this was big time. I went to school in Athens, Ohio. I'm from Cleveland, and here I am in New York, and I'm going to write poetry, and I asked myself, what the hell am I doing here? And you know about three-card Monte? Don't play it, if you ever, because I'll tell you, this is what happens. It's called three-card Monte, because it happened to me. And it's a cautionary tale. I walked everywhere on that island, an island myself, 20, just up from the Midwest, ready to begin that long book called My Life, aimless, swayed by whatever was at hand, strolling, blind. On Fifth Avenue, a figure, emaciated, barely distinguishable in the skyscraper's shadow, on the steaming sidewalk, inside of a circle of watchers. Above his podium cardboard box, he flashed three cards, two clubs and one heart, the queen, then turned them over in the quick slide, hands gliding like acrobats, the cards revolving around and over and under and through until they lost their shapes, spinning like blades, as if by some inner force, a fast-forward choreography. I couldn't keep my eyes off when I was sure to be the queen, the one to watch, certain if I held her attention, it would prove something I needed, what I had to master, this street preacher staring straight into my eyes, whispering, his voice like gravel, "A 20 will get you 100. And I was confident in the heart I tracked, staked my savings on what my eyes stalked. Of course, I was wrong, and I returned to the Midwest, where I had to start again from scratch, following in my mind the movement of those cards and the brilliant fingers that manipulated them until they became a blur like that city I'm no longer certain was there at all. This next one's for Jim, from Rabbits of the Air. And this is not a Jewish poem, and I am not a Jewish poet. I read this in the newspaper, and I thought it would make such a great poem that all those Jewish poets out there would be envious of me. It's called Hasidim in New Square, New York, Hear Carp Speaking Hebrew. And, you know, it's Hasidim are Jewish. You know, like two women are talking, and Jewish women, and one woman says, "I just can't find a Jewish guy in this town. It's just so hard." And then, an Orthodox Jew with the black hat and the sideburns goes by, and the second woman says, "Well, what about him?" She says, "No, not that Jewish." Well, this is about those Hasidim in New Square, New York, who hear a carp speaking Hebrew. Latest miracle, back of a local fish market. A carp opened its mouth and declared, I am the soul of a dead childless chassid. I was sent to do good deeds on earth. It spoke first to its executioner, Louis Navalno, one of the non-believers, just as it was about to be gutted. The fish is talking, Navalno screamed. The fish is talking. Zalman Rosen, his boss, rushed into the room and the fish, in the ancient tongue, confirmed. Yes, I am the soul of a departed Jew. Come back to relieve your burdens, to heal your sick of heart, to give strength to the weary. Then it slid into the fish pile. Attempts to recover it were fruitless. One carp looking so much like another. The way they can slip and slide until lost among the school. When the workers called in their ache to reaffirm, why didn't it respond? Why didn't it raise its voice out of the heap of its inarticulate brethren and distinguish itself again? So it was sold with the rest. Some believe it was as the parting of the Red Sea, as the giving of the commandments. Report spread. A carp spoke God's word. The Messiah is coming. Such was the rumor. The local rabbi decreed, to honor this wonder, everyone should eat carp for a week. It's true. It's a true story. All right, I'm going to fill a couple requests, and you don't get often get requests, so. 6 years ago, my brother died in a tragic car accident. We're going to change the mood here a little bit for a second. And he was jogging, and he was a famous scientist who was working on, discovered a receptor in a cell. He was a cellular biologist at Albert Einstein Medical College, and he got hit by a car while jogging. And there's a whole section in this book about that, seven-part section called To a Scientist Dying Young. And I'm just going to read one section from it. And I was thinking about what it is we own, what it is we experience with somebody else over the course of a lifetime or the course of a relationship. And those little experiences or big experiences, happy and sad experiences, are what we own, those people. So this is called What We Own, and this is what my brother and I own, I guess. And he can't argue with me this time, so he's going to have to take it. I followed you down the switchback trail of the Grand Canyon, and we slept in a crevice, and we own that. And we own those moments tossing the football in front of 4073 Wincote Road until the streetlight snapped on. And we own the smoke bomb the cops threw at us and a few thousand others at the Jefferson Airplane Concert, Akron, Ohio, 1972. And we own the whole country we passed through, all the way to the ocean, where we checked into a hotel, and you discovered, lying atop a Gideon's Bible, a black film canister's worth of weed, and a half a pack of rolling papers, and we smoked it, and it was good, unbelieving of our luck, which we own, and the lunar landscape surrounding our tent in Big Bend, Texas, and the stars so clear we could read by them, and we did, and we own The Godfather, Part 1, on the big screen of that packed theater in Evanston, Illinois, and we own that fear when we were lost in the Tennessee woods, into the dark, and you followed some analytical instinct until we found, lo and behold, a road. And Bob Dylan, who was ours, and Joan Baez, who was also ours, singing The Times They Are A-Changin' in the War Memorial, and watching the Indians, miracle of miracles, beat the New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium during the 1995 heat wave. That too, that victory was ours. And I remember how quiet you sometimes were, and I asked you about it, and you said it's a feeling you get. You don't know how to talk about it, and I'd like to think we own that feeling, how we bested the myths. We didn't become murderer and victim. We didn't cheat on the other's birthright. Oh, my brother of the other world, my brother who perhaps will greet me when I arrive at that place prepared for by our Father, who is now joined by his own flesh and blood, which is not blood, which is not flesh, but bones and perhaps spirit, which we believe in, like the moon, or the unpredictable Cleveland weather, or the way the snow descends on the fallen leaves, or how the sun glazes them now, for their moment, stirred in the slight wind, that same wind that blew the Jerusalem dust in our faces, which we own. Thank you. I'll just read a couple more. This is from the title poem, The Torah Garden, which I'm just going to read one or two sections, maybe one, because it is June, after all. So this takes place in June. The Torah Garden brings this Jewish stuff together with the garden and the rural nature and all that. But this is just one about the garden, and June is paradise in a garden. If anybody has a garden, you all know you don't have to be in a garden to know this is paradise, right? June, gorgeous. Tomorrow night's the solstice. I'm going to talk more about that. So this is just a section from the Torah Garden poem. You do not count on this abundance, but all winter long you consult the texts, ordered the seeds, dusted the grow lights, began again the plotting of what goes where. Every year you hold true to your imagined Eden. You tilled the soil, planted the seed, weeded and watered, cultivating your obligations to the earth. Swallowtail surveyed the tassels. Wind every so often reopened its song. And the poems I wrote were full of loss, but of loss with grace, in the shadow of a willow. We were finding our way into a rhythm, recalling who we were. June, after all, what you wanted to hold on to. Roses against the red brick, poppies soft as tissues, strawberries fully red and hidden in the unmown grasses, the mock orange spreading its white blossoms over the porch swing. When the petals drop, the children call them warm snowflakes. June, season of tomato steaks and tossing straw onto the potatoes, hard green apples and blueberries and grapes shaping themselves, the flowering blackberries proliferating along the field's edge, and late afternoon, the sun rounding the sky's absolute blue, the garden layered in shadow, the children splashing their thin bodies against the heat. You pause, hands resting on the handle of your hoe, the sweat of your body's labor sweetening the air, and allow yourself the distraction that perhaps, yes, it's all one continuous blossoming, these cells that everywhere sing their pulsing songs, your life. All right. Wow. All right, I'm going to close with one more poem. I cannot resist. It is the solstice tomorrow. Right, the longest day of the year, June 20th. And so I have a poem called The Solstice. You know, it's about my neighborhood. Do we have time for this one more poem? Yeah? Okay, because it just kind of rails. I tried to get a friend to play percussion. Anybody play percussion and have a drum with you? No? Well, you can bang on the tables. There you go, Mike. Okay, it's going to take a... Go. All right, because we really need percussion on this thing. But here we go. Just have to roll with it. It's called Solstice, and I come from a place called, affectionately called Barkeyville. It's up north in the country, and they had a big drumming fire thing. There's kind of like full moon drumming up there, a bunch of old hippies up there. So this is called Solstice for the Barkeyville Triangle, Mike Worcester. I know you like that. Because we are moving through the waters of our lives, because of neighbors around a fire, a drum in each lap, because this is the brightest dusk we have known all year, we tap our congas and kalambas, we clap, clatter, and racket, we beat a ruffle and establish our rhythm, slapping the steer hide, a pulsing powwow, purging our accumulated pressures, the djambi and the akaiko and the rum drum and the rattles. And some clicked sticks, and some made whistles and flutes with their hands, and someone blew the didgeridoo. You know how to pronounce that? Didgeridoo, thank you. Didgeridoo. Someone blew the didgeridoo too much wine. Because we are alive, we make music. We announce our joyful uproar that is all at once the history and hieroglyphics of our hearts. Because each of us holds down a day job. We've replaced slate tiles and nailed in 2x4s and counseled souls who thought they were lost. Pounded in tomato steaks and spoken calmly to a weeping child. Handled a backhoe until baptized in our own waters. We've worked hard for our wages, run our errands, dusted, and each of us have at some time or another felt the lingering of the light. Each of us have measured our tempos with the pulses of this longest day of the year. Because of the winter, as expected, lasted longer than our expectations. Because the spring was way too wet. Because we are also the force that will not stop accumulating. This insistence toward our own fulfillment. What is it that keeps us building more rooms, planting more seeds, raising more children? What is this that keeps us turning over our earth? We know we are dying. Some of us are breaking down right now. Some of us have had limbs removed and the cancer has shot up their spine. This hour, some of us are watching our own hearts turning inside out and squeezed dry. We know the chaotic smugness of the dark apartments. We know the way the shattered edges of a light bulb feel in our palms at 3 a.m. We know how words can lay splattered like vomit on our own clothing. There is no accounting of how all this gets layered in with the way we watched the full moon appear piece by piece until it was fully realized. Like when you stare at a face, the contours of the bones will clarify. Because we know we have somehow made it to this moment, though we don't know how or why. Because we all have our theories. Each of us will sit you down and look you in the eyes and explain for hours what is really an elaborate summary of how we came to be alive at this particular place and time. Because the lettuce picked an hour ago has gone to our heads. What with all that sunlight and soil digesting through our systems, all that leafy succulence breaking down and changing us. Because the sky has become the color of the fire. Thanks.